It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Wesley J. Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute. His topic is Bioethics with a Worldview.
It's always interesting to come to these events, and sometimes I'm called doctor, which is kind of a promotion. I'm actually a lawyer. Please don't hold that against me. I bring you greetings from California. Star. The land of Arnold. The land of Governor Moon. Jerry Brown is now the adult in the state. You know, I recently saw a photograph of my former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, with his shirt off. And he looked like just any other 60-year-old something man. So I called my wife and I said, honey, you know how I've always wanted to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger? Now I do. I want to thank Janine and Molly for having me here, and I want to thank all of you for coming out on a Friday. And I saw some white stuff coming out of the sky yesterday. I wasn't quite sure what that was, but it's always nice to come to the Sun Belt. You know, when we're asked to deal with these kinds of issues that I'm going to be addressing today, which has to do with bioethics. Biomedical ethics, it's a contraction for biomedical ethics. What are the ethics and morality of healthcare and public policy surrounding healthcare? And you begin to look around and you see that the woman, how many of you saw in the news, the elderly woman who went down and then the nurse at the nursing home, it wasn't even a nursing home, it was an independent living center, refused to give her CPR. And she called 911 and the 911 operator was desperate. To please, is there anyone there who will help this woman? And the nurse said, not at this time. How do we get to that place where the first instinct is to not save somebody's life, perhaps because they're elderly? In this situation, there was apparently a policy at this independent living center that if something happened, the nurse is to not do intervene. Why are you a nurse? But that's a different issue. But to call 911. And how do we get there? And I've been thinking about that. I've been doing this kind of work for about 20 years. And it was always the why now question to me. For example, Jack Kevorkian is out assisting the suicide of mostly non-terminally ill people, mostly disabled people, people with disabilities, five people who weren't even sick on their autopsies, whose goal, by the way, was human research, medical, human vivisection. He wrote in his book, Prescription Medicide, that helping suffering people was just a professional obligation, distasteful. His real desire was to do experiments on people he was euthanizing. He wrote it in his book. And yet, he became one of the, quote, heroes of the 1990s to the point where Al Pacino played him in an award-winning movie. How do we get to that place? And I mean, people in the 1890s, if they had a burst appendix, they would die in agony. And there was no real talk of euthanasia then. So how do we get to that place? Well, there are a lot of answers, but one of them is that the purpose of society has shifted. It has shifted from promoting righteousness. It is shifting from promoting liberty, in my view. It is shifted from promoting rule of law to preventing suffering at whatever cost. And this insight came to me from a book called Imagining the Future by Yuval Levin. Yuval Levin, some of you may have read him. He's on National Review a lot. He writes in the Weekly Standard. He worked for President Bush as a science bioethics advisor. And he wrote the book, Imagining the Future, which was about the embryonic stem cell research issue, which I won't get into really today. And he was trying to explain conservatives to liberals and liberals to conservatives. But he wrote this, and this is what happened that, you know, I should have had a V8 moment, where he says, the worldview of modern science sees health not only as a foundation, but also a principal goal, not only as a beginning, but also an end. Relief and preservation from disease and pain, from misery and necessity, become the defining ends of human action, therefore of human societies. And that is really an important point. And it strikes across a whole wide gamut. If preventing suffering is the end-all and be-all of a society, it doesn't take long before the way you prevent suffering is to prevent the sufferer. I want you to think about my Uncle Bruno Micheletti. One of my favorite memories as a small child is my Uncle Bruno Micheletti was a real teaser. He picked me up. And he was twirling me around and pretending like he was going to throw me off the slope in front of my parents' house. And I remember I was laughing and giggling because I knew my Uncle Bruno Micheletti was not going to throw me off the slope. And I remember his black hair was flying, and it was I just have this flash memory still, I was probably three, of a very joyful moment with my uncle. Fast forward 50 years. And my uncle is dying of Alzheimer's disease. And he's bald. And he's in a wheelchair. And he's got glaucoma. And it's a very difficult time for him, obviously. And a difficult time for my family. And I remember the last time I went to see my uncle, just a few days before he died. And I went to my uncle and I said, "Uncle Bruno, it's me." And I said, "I just want to shake my uncle's hand." And a great miracle occurred because he took his hand off and he held it out. And I grasped his hand and I said, "Uncle Bruno, do you remember when we went fishing?" And he thought a second. He said, "Yeah, I was pretty good." He was a terrible fisherman. He used to always get seasick. But I had that wonderful moment. And it hit me at that moment. If ending suffering and preventing suffering is the purpose of society, then my uncle in this wonderful Alzheimer's unit that he was in was a causer of suffering. I mean, think about it. He suffered. And there's no question he suffered. It was a difficult time. My aunt, his wife, suffered watching her husband of 50-some years going through this terrible experience. In fact, she suffered so much that when she wanted to go take care of him, when we first had to move him from their apartment in the assisted living into the Alzheimer's unit, she went running down the stairs to try to get my uncle something, and she fell and broke her hip. That's how hard it was for her. My cousin, their daughter, suffered. The last time she saw him, he didn't recognize her. My mother, his sister, suffered watching her beloved older brother. My mother's father had died at age 5 in 1922 in Central Falls, Rhode Island. And in those days, all you had was family. And my uncle became the protector of my mother, who was very pretty. And I've heard stories of how he made sure that she was treated with respect. So my mother suffered. I suffered watching these people. But it goes even beyond that. The people who were caring for my uncle suffered. Because every day they would see 50 adults in a terrible, terrible disease situation, in a difficult time. And it takes a special kind of human being to be able to go to work every day and have such compassion, which, by the way, means to suffer with. That's the root meaning of compassion, to suffer with. And we're getting to a place in society, rather than suffering with, we're doing away with. And that has to stop. But you could even take it further and think of that in the context of the Affordable Care Act. Society suffered because of the costs of taking care of my Uncle Bruno. And so if preventing or reducing or eliminating suffering becomes the purpose of society, then if you become a causer of suffering, you're in big trouble. And I think you see that also in the abortion issue. And I'm sure there are a lot that you could go through and circumstances in your life. And we have to help people understand, yes, of course we want to mitigate suffering. It is our job to have compassion, to carry other people's burdens on our shoulders sometime so they can keep walking. That's a really human society. But if the purpose is to always eliminate it, one, it can't be done. And two, it's utopian, and utopianism leads to tyranny. So our purpose of society cannot be to eliminate suffering. And a part of that can be to mitigate, and should be, to mitigate suffering. And that's what you all do all the time. But that's where we're at. And that's the why now issue. And think about this as it comes into the context of healthcare costs having to be reduced. That is an important issue. It can be done properly, morally, and ethically with a proper understanding of the sanctity and equality of all human life. Human exceptionalism. Does human life have ultimate meaning simply merely because it's human? That's the most important question of this century, because people are saying no across a broad array of ideologies and social movements. If you say yes, which of course I believe we should, and I know you think we should, then we devise policies that promote that, let's say, it's not a first principle, but it's close to a first principle. Yes, we're going to have ideas, ethics, laws, regulations, personal individual activity that stands up for the ultimate value of human life. But if you say no, being human is morally irrelevant, then you have to ask yourself a second question, don't you? And that question is, well, if it isn't being human, what is it? And you're seeing some very interesting answers. For example, in the animal rights movement, I'm not talking about animal welfare, animal rights, which is an ideology and it's a different speech. I could do that. No. they say it isn't being human that gives value, it's the ability to feel pain, the ability to suffer. And therefore, they call it panience. And therefore, since a cow can feel pain and a human can feel pain, then cattle ranching is akin to human slavery. And they believe that literally. And again, the word human rights, animal rights is used too loosely. It often means animal welfare. And we're all for animal welfare because caring for animals properly and humanely is a human duty, because we are moral beings. And it is our obligation to treat animals humanely, human duties. That's part of human exceptionalism too. So you begin to see, in New Zealand, they've declared that a river is a person. They did, and they've created Nature Rights Star. They created Nature Rights in Santa Monica, which is about 50 miles north of where you live. I grew up in L.A., I know Santa Monica like the back of my hand. There's no nature left in Santa Monica. And they're not going to tear down the pier for the mackerel. So it's ideological. And it's a way of destroying the unique value of human life, because if nature has rights, then the very concept of rights loses its meaning, doesn't it? It becomes like currency in inflation. It fades away, because if you look and you say, oh, that squirrel has the same rights as a human, one, you know the squirrel in your heart, your gut, you know that's not right, but it detracts from the value of humanity, and we can begin to look and abandon each other as we see happening all around us. Well, getting to the bioethical issue, I'm going to bring you today not just my opinion of what is being promoted at the highest levels of bioethics. We're talking about at the most prestigious universities, the Oxfords, the Cambridges, the Princeton, the Yales, the Harvards, but also showing you from their words where they would like us to take our bioethical policies and what that might mean. A really helpful in this regard is a article that was written by a bioethicist from the UK named Alastair Cochrane, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E, in the journal Bioethics, December 2009. By the way, if you want to see what's really going wrong in the country and in the world, read the professional journals. That doesn't get covered a lot by the media, but when you see the things that are being written in these medical journals, these bioethical journals, I used to have black hair. And this fellow Cochrane says that we should not use human exceptionalism or the unique dignity of human life as the basis of our bioethical policies. And he gets into the concept of dignity. Well, there's, of course, acting dignified. And the first thing is, well, the Three Stooges, for example. Hey, Mo, woo-woo, how many of you like the Three Stooges? I grew up on usually men, right? Women go, oh, please. But men, it's like, woo-woo-woo, hey, wah-wah. That's slapstick. The Three Stooges did not act in a dignified manner. they had dignity. And of course, that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about activity. My wife saying, Wesley, there you go again. That's not very dignified. Yes, I know, dear. But I still have dignity. I have unique dignity. Terry Schiavo, when she lay dehydrating to death over 14 days, had unique dignity. When blood formed in her eyes, according to her brother Bobby Schindler, as she was dying because they wouldn't even put ice chips on her lips, she still had dignity. Except some people didn't see that. And that leads to some very terrible consequences, as it did for her. So Cochrane says, after dealing with the acting in a dignified manner, the second important conception of dignity that we need to consider does not see dignity as a form of behavior, but as a property. Under this conception of the possession of dignity by humans signifies that they have an inherent moral worth. So it's not like these people don't understand what they're doing. They do precisely. I couldn't have said it better. They have an inherent moral worth. In other words, because human beings possess dignity, we cannot do what we like to them, but instead have direct moral obligations toward them. Indeed, this understanding of dignity is also considered to serve as the undergrounding for human rights. Absolutely. As Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Very well stated, very articulately stated. And yet he still rejects that approach to bioethics. He writes, this conception of dignity as inherent moral worth certainly seems coherent enough as an idea. It's the foundation of this country. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the philosophy of the United States of America. And that sentence is probably the most profound secular sentence ever written in terms of promoting freedom and liberty around the world, because even in the most tyrannous societies, they give at least lip service to the idea of freedom and liberty. So he says, as I said, this conception of dignity as inherent moral worth certainly seems coherent enough as an idea. Indeed, we can also see why this conception of dignity is employed in certain debates around bioethics. For if all individual human beings possess dignity, then they should not be viewed simply as resources that we can treat however we please. To take an example, then, it may be that we could achieve rapid and significant progress in medical science if we were to conduct wide-ranging medical experiments on groups of human beings. However, because human beings have dignity, so it is argued, this means that they possess a particular quality that grounds certain moral obligations and rights. In other words, we can't turn people into copper mines or timber forests. But we're doing just that. If you look around the world, what I call biological colonialism is running rampant, buying the organs of the destitute, using destitute women to gestate children. You know what is the most valuable commodity in the world, ounce for ounce? Think about what that might be. Is it titanium? No. Is it gold? No. Human eggs. A good-looking, a beautiful, intelligent college young woman can get $50,000 or $80,000 for about 30 eggs, which you'd have to look at in a microscope to see. Ounce for ounce. Now, it might mean that in some cases she might die. It happens rarely, donating the eggs because of the onerous thing that women have to go through. She might have an infection. She might lose her fertility. But that isn't really stressed. And in fact, I urge all of you to go to the Center for Bioethics and Culture and take a look at their movie, Eggsploitation, and see the problems that can come from treating young women as a source of eggs. In other words, a commodity. I don't have time to get into that, but it's a very important thing. So around the world, as I said, I mean, there are people who buy organs from poor Indian people who then often have, with one kidney, have a difficult time. And in a situation in which they don't have access to adequate medical care. He goes on, if all human beings possess dignity, this extraordinary moral worth, we need some explanation of what it is about the species Homo sapiens that make them so deserving. When we start looking at particular characteristics that might ground dignity, language use, moral action, sociality, sentience, self-consciousness, and so on, we soon see that none of these qualities are in fact possessed by each and every human. In other words, what he's saying is, you don't look at the inherent value, the inherent dignity of a human being, an objective value that you don't have to earn by possessing certain capacities. He's saying we have to look individual by individual by individual. And we will judge their moral value, which will be relative, depending on their capacities of the moment. So right now they would say, yes, even though we think Wesley is saying terrible things and he's terribly wrong, we will have to concede that he has those moral capacities that ground highest moral value because I'll get into this called a person. But if Wesley stepped outside and wasn't aware that there's such a thing as freezing weather in Ohio and slipped on the ice and hit his head, and if I was seriously injured, they might say, well, gee, now look at him. Well, he doesn't have the dignity he used to have. He doesn't have the value he used to have. Maybe we can use him if he stays in this situation as a organ mine, as a mere natural resource. Because there are a lot of suffering people who have better use for Wesley's liver than he does now, because they could lead lives of greater quality than what Wesley has. It's called the quality of life ethic, and they're trying to replace that, have that replace the sanctity of life ethic. And he says, obviously, given these controversies over abortion, stem cell research, genetic interventions, animal experimentation, euthanasia, and so on, bioethics does need to engage in debates over which entities, by the way, they mean in, as opposed to animals and plants and so forth, possess moral worth and why, but these are best conducted by using the notion of moral status and arguing over the characteristics that warrant possession of it. Simply stipulating that all and only human beings possess this inherent moral worth because they have dignity is arbitrary and unhelpful. It's unhelpful if you want to treat people as equals, yeah. It's unhelpful if you want to be able to exploit people who can't defend themselves, yeah. But it's incredibly crucial if you want a society based on universal human rights and universal freedom and universal equality. Because if human life doesn't have value simply because it's human, all of those things are impossible. Because there will be some people who do not possess those attributes that the big-brained think are required to have value. And he closes with, I urge for an undignified bioethics. Well, I urge for a sanctity of life bioethics. Because all our lives and our safety depend on it, and decency and morality depend on it. Let's take a look at what some of the major bioethicists, and this, by the way, bioethics is not a unified field in the sense that everybody agrees with everything that's said for each other. But what I'm going to talk about and the things I'm going to be addressing as that are the mainstream view. There are, of course, others, human rights bioethicists, Catholic bioethicists, others who dissent. Leon Cass, who headed the President's Council on Bioethics, believes in dignity, intrinsic dignity. That's why he got so much grief from his colleagues once the president appointed him to that position. So, while the mainstream bioethics doesn't necessarily believe in everything as we're going to describe uniformly, it's kind of like Catholics and Baptists arguing. In other words, there's a common underlying belief, and there may be some discussion about the details. But what I just read and what I'm going to be reading here is the mainstream view of the most influential bioethicists, and particularly those who will be manning the boards and the cost-benefit boards for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. these are very powerful, prominent people, and in a law that now puts the experts in control, when the experts don't believe in sanctity of life, we got trouble right here in River City. So this is about the idea is personhood. When Terry Schiavo was being dehydrated to death, I was doing a lot of advocacy around that issue, and I had a debate on Court TV with a bioethicist, and we went through the case, and people had heard the case, the facts, and you know. So I finally said, let's get to the bottom line. Do you think that Terry Schiavo is a person? He said, no, she's not, because she had lost these attributes which I'll describe. I said, does that mean that instead of dehydrating her to death, we should be able to take her organs? He said, yes, we should, because they become a matter of property just like any other part of property that could be inherited or left. And that's the danger of an undignified bioethics. In this, this is an article from the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, December 1999, by John Harris, PhD. He's got a bunch of places he serves, but he's one of the big bioethicists in the UK and very influential in that society's quality of life rationing system for the National Health Service. And he wrote, Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, December 1999. And that's not somebody with a pyramid on their head sitting in a corner on the internet. That would be me. This is, if it's in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, this is big time bioethics. This is mainstream bioethics. This is also on Georgetown University campus. It is a Catholic school. And yet, in the concept of the person and value of life, he writes, many, if not most, of the problems of healthcare ethics presuppose that we have a view about what sorts of beings have something that we might think of as ultimate moral value. Or if this sounds too apocalyptic, then we certainly need to identify those sorts of individuals who have the highest moral value or importance. Think about that. If he had said, we need to identify the race that has the highest moral value or importance, we would say, sir, that is bigoted, and we would be right. This is the same invidious thinking, just different victims. And victims, by the way, who can't defend themselves. He goes on to say, person, and then he says, what matters is whether a being or an individual is a person. And where does that lead us? He says, he writes later, personhood provides a species neutral. How many of you have heard of speciesism? Not too many. Speciesism is rampant in bioethics, and it's, of course, rampant in animal rights. Speciesism says that if you treat a human being differently than an animal, merely because the human being is human or because the animal is an animal, that is speciesism, which is akin to racism. And it is becoming a value system that is permeating our bioethical thinking and our environmental thinking and so forth. And again, that's another speech. I don't have time to go there right now. Personhood provides a species neutral, that's what that's about, way of grouping creatures that have lives that would be wrong to end by killing or by letting die. These may include animals, machines, extraterrestrials, gods, angels, or devils. What he's saying is, what we need to do is take an individual. Let's say we're going to compare Wesley and my dog Porthos. We'll see which of us has the higher attributes, and based on that, we will decide which has the higher value of life. But there are some people who through injury or immaturity or illness might have lower capacities than Porthos, for those people, they would have a lower value than Porthos. That's what he's talking about, just to put it in a very stark term. He says, persons who want to live are wrong by being killed because they are thereby deprived of something they value. Relativism with a capital R. Killing isn't wrong because it's wrong. Murder isn't wrong because it's wrong. It depends on whether the individual killed has something they can value. I don't have time to go there. And he says, that's why we should have euthanasia, which is another speech. Non-persons or potential persons cannot be wronged in this way because death does not deprive them of anything they can value. If they cannot wish to live, they cannot have that wish frustrated by being killed. Think about that. It tells us who we can kill and get a good night's sleep. And then a fellow named, another major bioethicist named Tom Beauchamp, or Beauchamp, B-E-A-U-C-H-A-M-P, writing in the same Kennedy Institute of Ethics journal, goes even further. Because remember, we're a logical species. And when you accept a premise, you're going to take it where it leads. He writes, because many humans lack properties of personhood or are less than full persons, they are thereby rendered equal or inferior in moral standing to some non-humans. If this conclusion is defensible, we will need to rethink our traditional view that unlucky humans cannot be treated in the ways we treat relevantly similar non-humans. For example, they might be aggressively used as human research subjects and sources of organs. Somebody's going to be giving me a time, and I can't see back there, so they're going to have to do it up here. Thanks. I'm just getting wound up. where does this lead? Well, you've all, how many of you have heard of Peter Singer? Peter Singer, most of you have. Peter Singer is an Australian bioethicist, what's called a moral philosopher, which in his case is an oxymoron. And this is what he wrote about, and he's best known, and it's not coincidental, he jump-started the animal liberation movement. And he is the world's foremost promoter of infanticide as an ethical and moral behavior. And here's what he wrote in his book, Practical Ethics, which, by the way, is taught in every major university philosophy department. And you'll see who he's, what kind of a supposedly disabled infant he's describing here. He says, when the death of a disabled infant will lead to the birth of another infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness will be greater if the disabled infant is killed. Think about what he just wrote. He wasn't even saying that if a baby is born who has a disabled sibling, it would be better to kill the disabled sibling to help the baby who is not disabled. He was talking about if a disabled sibling is born, and there might not ever be another sibling. It's a hypothetical future sibling. And notice that we're promoting, this is utilitarianism, we're promoting the greatest amount of happiness and reducing suffering. And what happens? A child, a baby born with difficulties can be killed because we want to promote happiness, particularly of a potential future child who may or may not ever be born. But understand that under Peter Singer's thinking, disability is irrelevant. Why is the baby killable? The baby is killable because the baby is deemed not a person, not because the baby's disabled. He's just too good a politician to use the concept of a healthy baby who isn't wanted. But it's based on that criteria of personhood that he says this child would be killable. And then let me finish this off. The loss of a happier life for the first infant is outweighed by the gain of a happier life for the second. So he's not even saying that the first infant who gets killed wouldn't have happiness. It just wouldn't be as much as the brother or sisters. Who doesn't want to be burdened with a disabled sibling, don't you know? Therefore, if killing the hemophiliac infant has no adverse effect on others, what about the baby? It would, according to the total view, be right to kill him. That's where we go when you have undignified bioethics. How many of you remember about a year ago the afterbirth abortion controversy? Did you all hear about that in the news? That's very relevant, too. This was written in the Journal of Medical Ethics, which is out of Oxford. And let me read real quickly what this was about. And this was in the context of a Down syndrome baby. Nonetheless, to bring up such children might be an unbearable burden on the family and on society as a whole when the state economically provides for their care. 5 minutes. You're mean. On these grounds, the fact that a fetus has the potential to become a person who will never have at least acceptable life is no reason for prohibiting abortion. Therefore, we argue that when circumstances occur after birth such that they should have justified abortion, what we call afterbirth abortion should be permissible. Now you'd say, well, they'd never do infanticide, right? They already are. Well, first there's partial birth abortion, but let's not go there. In the Netherlands, about 90 babies are killed each year as part of the euthanasia program. That's according to studies, for example, in The Lancet. 8% of all infant deaths in the Netherlands are caused by doctors killing them. It's against the law. It's supposedly murder, but nothing is ever done about it. And in fact, any time that efforts are made to prosecute a doctor, the medical community goes up in arms. In fact, doctors are so confident that they can kill babies in the Netherlands that you should look this up on the internet, the Groningen Protocol, G-R-O-N-I-N-G-E-N, Groningen Protocol. It's a bureaucratic checklist for determining whether to kill the baby. It was published, it's part of the Groningen University Medical Center in the Netherlands, and has been published with all due respect in the New England Journal of Medicine. And the people who did that used this checklist to kill disabled and terminally ill infants. And you see it also in Belgium and so forth. There's also argument, as I said, about Terry Schiavo for using people in that kind of severe cognitive disability, disabled condition as sources of organs. For example, in The Lancet, some doctors wrote for the International Forum for Transplant Ethics, if the legal definition of death were to be changed to include comprehensive irreversible loss of higher brain function, it would be possible to take the life of a patient, or more accurately, to stop the heart, since the patient would be defined as dead, by lethal injection and then remove the organs needed for transplantation. I used to say, well, that's not happening, and it's not happening in the United States. But in Belgium, which legalized euthanasia, they have now coupled euthanasia with organ harvesting. And I can't think of anything more dangerous than giving a utilitarian benefit to society for killing sick and disabled people, or a utilitarian benefit to a sick and disabled person in despair to be killed. And in fact, I have read some of the journals, and there was one that talked about the taking of four lungs. The four people who were euthanized and then harvested, three had neuromuscular disabilities. They were not terminally ill, like multiple sclerosis, and one was mentally ill. And because of that devastation, wanted to die, and the doctor said, sure. And then they said, well, would you want my liver? Yeah. That's the kind of society you end up with if you give up the sanctity of human life, if you reject human exceptionalism. I could go on and on, but let me end with this. Is there a duty to die? Guess what the answer is. And this was published in the Hastings Center Report, which is probably the most prestigious bioethics journal in the world. Back in 1997, John Hardwick, H-A-R-D-W-I-G. A duty to die is more likely when continuing to live will impose significant burdens. Here we go again. Emotional burdens, extensive caregiving, destruction of life plans, and yes, financial hardship on your family and loved ones. This is the fundamental insight underlying a duty to die. A duty to die becomes greater as you grow older. To have reached the age of, say, 75 or 80 years without being ready to die is itself a moral failing, the sign of a life out of touch with basic realities. My mother's 95. She sold her house. I'm an only child. She put that money in the bank. Of course, if I went to Mom and said, hey, Mom, I think you have a duty to die, she'd look at me and she'd say, no, son, you have the duty to die. You see what I'm talking about? You see where we go so easily once we say human life does not have intrinsic, unbelievable, unmeasurable, immeasurable value simply and merely because it's human. When we reject human exceptionalism, when we reject the sanctity of human life, we are rejecting the equality of human life, and we are on the road to tyranny. Thank you.
Questions. What is your view of hospice care? Is hospice a caring end-of-life service, or are some hospice trying to speed up death?
Hospice care, as designed by Dame Cecily Saunders, is a tremendously beneficial approach to helping people when they're in terminal illness. I've been a hospice volunteer. I hope any of you and all of you will consider doing that. There are, however, threats to the proper hospice approach, which, by the way, is not about dying. It's about living. It's about helping people live through symptom control, intervention, spiritual care, and so forth, including, by the way, suicide prevention. So hospice properly applied is terrific. I had the great honor for my book, Culture of Death, of interviewing Dame Cecily Saunders, who founded the modern hospice movement, who was incredibly against assisted suicide. She had retired. She ended up, when she died, dying in her own hospice. And she was asked by the New York Times, how would you like to die? And when I read the story, it was stunning. She said, by cancer. And it's like, what? And she said, because I know my pain could be controlled and I'd have time to say goodbye. So she knew what could be done. There are some hospices who don't understand the true hospice mission. I hope and I believe those are the exceptions, but it is always important if you have a loved one who has to go into hospice to make sure that you and the hospice are on the same ethical team, if you will.
And for those of you that are wondering perhaps how I have questions already, those little cards in the middle of your table, that's what they're for, writing down questions and then giving them to one of our hostesses, and they will then get them to me if time permits. Another question. Thank you. Isn't the next suffering where we're spending too much money to treat you so you are causing society to suffer? Is that where we are going with Obamacare?
If we're not careful, I think so. You see that under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the tremendous emphasis on cost containment and cost control. And that is actually going to result, I'm worried, in health care rationing. They have healthcare rationing in the United Kingdom. Under the NHS, it's the National Institute for Clinical and Health Excellence, NICE, which isn't very nice. For example, in the UK, they will not allow some late-stage cancer patients to get chemotherapy to extend their lives. They won't pay for it. But they will pay for a 42-year-old woman to have free IVF, even though being unable to conceive at age 42 is actually part of the natural process of aging. In Oregon, which rations care under Medicaid for poor people, back in 2008, Google Barbara Wagner, a woman who had lung cancer, was terminally ill. Her doctor prescribed her chemotherapy that to extend her life 9 months or a year, which is a normal part of cancer care. Medicaid in Oregon denied it because she wouldn't live long enough, but then they wrote in the letter, but we will pay for your assisted suicide. And she went crazy. She said, wait a second, you're saying that my life isn't worth paying for, but my death is? And that's precisely what they were saying. And in the UK, this NICE rationing board, they ration under what's called the quality adjusted life year. And I don't have time to get into it fully, but very roughly stated, let's say I have a friend who's in a wheelchair and he and I both get the same illness and we can get a treatment that'll extend our lives for 5 years. But I'm able-bodied, so the quality-adjusted life year would say, well, that's worth 5 years. But because he's in a wheelchair, they might say, and this is very rough, I mean, it's more complicated than this, well, his life is only worth 2 years, quality-adjusted life years. How much is this going to cost? $50,000 a year for Wesley, quality-adjusted life year, but $200,000 a year for Mark. Therefore, we'll give the treatment to Wesley, but not to Mark. And the quality-adjusted life year is being pushed for our country by the New England Journal of Medicine and others. You see the big brained, the establishment pushing for healthcare rationing as they yell at Sarah Palin for bringing up death panels. Well, they yelled at Sarah Palin because she nailed them.
Yeah.
And you know, if someone says to me, Star, you're a bank robber, I go, what? But if I'm a bank robber, I might say, hey, how dare you? When people yell because they've been nailed, you tend to understand there's some truth to what's being said.
We have so many wonderful questions and more coming, but only 5 minutes. So we have to either hurry through some of them or answer as appropriately, and we'll get to, I'll give you the stack and you can answer them later. Do these bioethics ethicists win?
Say that
Hitler was right. Or, so the question is, are they saying that Hitler was right? And if not, do they say he was wrong, and on what basis?
No, they would never say Hitler was right. But I think it's really dangerous to think that it was about Hitler. It wasn't about Hitler. It was a rejection of human exceptionalism that was in the eugenics movement. And the eugenics movement started in the eight, that's another whole speech too, but it basically said that it is the job of society to improve the human herd, if you will. And that ended up in this country with mandatory sterilizations, 60 to 70,000, approved by Buck v. Bell, the 1927 Supreme Court case, where Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, three generations of idiots are enough, and allowed a woman who had done nothing wrong except to be a child born out of wedlock who gave birth out of wedlock because she had been raped by a foster family member to be sterilized under the sanction of law. And actually the Nazis took their racial hygiene laws from the law of California. For example, the Nuremberg Code in Germany that allowed, in 33, allowed mass sterilization of the quote unfit was taken from the California law that already existed. So it wasn't the Nazis. That's kind of a way of saying, oh, we're not Nazis. We don't go around like this, you know. But it is the rejection of human exceptionalism inherent in eugenics, and is back with something called transhumanism that seeks to create a post-human species. So that's the real issue, and utopianism that says that we can somehow end all suffering through some kind of magic imposition by experts.
Wow, these questions are good. And I want to remind all of you that they are taping these sessions if it's a lot for you to digest. I think it's important that we continue this dialogue. Last question. What besides human beings is a legitimate legal person?
Well, there is in the law, corporations are, quote, persons, artificial persons. And often you will see let's say nature rights experts saying, well, if a corporation can be a person, why can't a stalk of corn? Well, the corporation and people can have an argument over whether a corporation should be a, quote, person. But that's a human association. So I don't think anything should be deemed a person outside of the human community.
Thank you.
Thanks,
again.
Sir.
Very, very, very informative and almost disheartening if we didn't know the Lord was on the throne.
You have been listening to Wesley J. Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute and 2013 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium Speaker.